From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. There is a long and troubling history of science, or at least pseudoscience, being used to justify racism and discrimination. The 19th century practice of phrenology, reading the skull, is one thoroughly debunked example. But in the 1970s, the emerging field of genetics began presenting evidence against a biological definition of race, and that has become the scientific consensus. Still, it's increasingly clear that there are genetic differences between populations, and some of those do correlate with contemporary ideas about race or ethnicity. For example, cystic fibrosis is most common among those of Northern European descent. Prostate cancer is more prevalent in men of Western African descent, and Tay-Sachs disease disproportionately affects Ashkenazi Jewish populations. David Reich is a professor of genetics at Harvard University and an investigator of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and his research is completely built on the idea that there are genetic differences between populations. He uses those differences to trace the movement of humans around the globe over the past five millennia, and he's worked many of those stories into his new book, Who We Are and How We Got Here. While much of his research looks at the past, he also has his eye on our present day and even future discussions about race, and he argues that we urgently need a new, open, and accurate way to talk about these genetic differences that doesn't open the door to racism. David, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. You recently had an op-ed in the New York Times entitled How Genetics is Changing Our Understanding of Race, and the word race was in scare quotes. Why?
Well, race, as we've known for many decades, is a socially constructed category. It corresponds to ideas about how to place people into groups that have changed over time from U.S. Census to U.S. Census. People who used to be of one, quote, race in one census would be categorized as a different race in another census. And so these are social categories that change over time, and they change from country to country. And that's fundamentally what they are. And yet they do have correspondence in some cases to average genetic differences.
For example, you've done some work identifying the genes that may be responsible for the elevated risk of prostate cancer in men of Western African descent. I wonder, in cases like that, where we can say, okay, here's a gene that makes this certain population more susceptible to a disease. I mean, that's important, potentially life-saving information that we want to have. Is it in any way important to have it connected, though, to something like, as it's often stated, that Black men in the U.S. are more susceptible to prostate cancer? Or can we use that kind of information completely independent of the construct of race?
I think the construct of race is very problematic in all sorts of ways. But in this country at this time, when people say they self-identified as African-American, for example, it says with very high probability that that person has between 5 and 60% of their ancestry from Europeans, and the great majority of the rest of their ancestry from Africans. So it provides information about the ancestors, the places where a person's ancestors lived 500 years ago. And for that reason, it provides some rapid information about increased and decreased susceptibilities to some diseases that are affected by genetics.
It does, as you were just saying, provide sort of a shortcut, perhaps, to getting to that information. Do we have the technology at this point, though, to avoid those shortcuts? Maybe just sequence everybody's genome and find out if they have those genes without worrying about their self-identified ethnic ancestry?
I think that's a really interesting idea. There's been a number of papers that have thought about that, that in the future of precision medicine, what we'll do is we'll just sequence everybody's genome. Most of the differences that we see amongst people are amongst individuals, not amongst populations. Population identity, or quote, race identity, is a very poor proxy for the average for predicting people's biological traits. And so in the future, if we want to use genetics, maybe we should just study everyone. I think our ability to make predictions biologically about people based on genetics is actually currently quite poor, but it will probably get substantially better in the future. And in that future, I think that these labels will be used less and less.
I'm talking with Harvard geneticist David Reich. He's author of Who We Are and How We Got Here. A lot of your work isn't necessarily focused on the modern genetic differences between populations, but looking at ancient populations and tracing how these populations of people moved and migrated around, how they interacted with each other, in some cases how one population was overtaken by another. I wonder how that kind of work and that understanding of the deeper history of how we got to where we are right now, how that has affected your ideas about things like race or ethnicity.
I think it's affected it quite profoundly. So I, like a lot of people in childhood, had a picture in my head of what the nature of human variation was, what explained the differences amongst the apparent differences amongst the different groups and categories I saw around me. And in the course of my work and the work that I've been part of as a field over the last 10 years, almost every assumption that we've had about those differences has been exploded. So just to give a concrete example, the category of whites today, say Europeans or Near Easterners, actually doesn't reflect an age-old group that's been around for tens of thousands of years. In fact, research we published in 2016 showed that whites today are the result of a mixture, and just within the last 5 or 10,000 years, of four groups, each as different from each other as Europeans and East Asians today. If we were able to go back in time to 10,000 years in Europe or into the Near East and look around us at that time, all of those four groups probably would have been considered as, quote, races. But today, genetically, the region is homogeneous and all of the relatively homogeneous, and all of those groups have contributed substantially to people living in that region today.
As you say, this research has occasionally completely blown up ideas that we've held about our own ancestries. I wonder how some of the people in the different places where you've studied ancestry have reacted to those changes to their stories. And I'm thinking in particular about some of your work looking at Polynesia and the waves of migration, and whether ancient Polynesians, those who first came to some of these South Pacific islands, were coming from Asia or from Papua New Guinea. How did understanding the genetic story change their picture of their ancestry, and how did they respond to that change?
So I'm not so sure I'm an expert in trying to, I can tell you really how people have responded to these genetic findings in Vanuatu and other remote oceanic islands. But I can tell you a little bit about the findings, and the findings are really extraordinary. Probably the most amazing migration in human history is the one that started a little bit more than 3,000 years ago, when people from New Guinea and East Asia started going into the open Pacific with these canoes with a log tied on their, logs tied on the side to stabilize them through the open Pacific. And within a couple of thousand years, they had gone everywhere. These islands that were unoccupied, New Zealand, Hawaii, Madagascar, even off the coast of Africa, before that were suddenly occupied by these extraordinary people speaking very similar languages that are far flung over all these places today. Today, all of the people across the remote Pacific have a lot of ancestry from New Guinea, the large island to the north of Australia. And it was thought by most geneticists that that was because the people coming out from Taiwan via the Philippines passed New Guinea and mixed with them before going out into the open Pacific. So last year, we published data from Vanuatu, which is one of the first stepping stone islands out into this route into the open Pacific. And we found that those first people had almost no New Guinean ancestry at all, that the first people moved through New Guinea region with almost not mixing with those people. And it was only later waves, and we now know in the most recent work, at least two or three later waves that brought New Guinean ancestry again and mostly replaced this initial spread. And so what's really clear in Pacific, as it is clear in Europe and also clear in parts of Africa we've studied and in the Near East and in India and in Central Asia, is that there have been waves and waves of mass population movement, mixture, and often replacement or partial replacement so that almost every group in the world today, almost without exception, is not directly descended from the first people who got there, but is instead the result of mixture. We're all mixed. We're all the product of mixture, not just of our parents, but of different populations.
Can you talk a little bit about how you reconstruct these histories? I mean, you're getting ancient DNA in a lot of cases from bones from 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 years ago. But then how does that correlate to figuring out, you know, this person was sailing from Taiwan or from Papua New Guinea to Vanuatu? How do you start to put that together?
So that's what the technology that we and others have developed, the statistical technology, allows us to do with a lot of precision. I'll take just the example that you started with of African Americans. So today, African Americans are a mixture of mostly West African or European ancestry due to ancestors who lived on those continents 500 years ago. And the way that we can determine where a person's section of person's genome comes from is to study whether the genetic variations that differ amongst people in any one section of the genome tend to match more closely to those in present-day people or even ancient DNA samples from those regions. And so by comparing a test group that we're analyzing to a lot of reference groups and seeing how much sharing the test group has to all of these populations, we can often make extremely precise, exquisitely accurate estimates of the fraction of lineages of ancestral lines of descent in any one person come from these different sources.
If we just think about the way that evolution works, any two groups who are isolated from each other for some period of time will start to develop genetic differences from one another. How different do populations need to be for you to be able to distinguish between them on a genetic level and trace their movements in a genetic way? And how long does it take for those kinds of differences to arise and to evolve?
Well, the rate of difference at which human differences arise is about 1 in a billion per DNA letter per year. Sounds tiny, but our genomes are a few billion DNA letters long. And as a result, there's mutations that accumulate every year and dozens every generation, each of which provides us with information we can use to differentiate people. As an example of the exquisite accuracy with which genetic data can differentiate even very closely related people, there was a study published just a couple of years ago from Britain, from the island of Britain, which was able to break down the extremely closely related of people in Britain into 17 extremely distinct genetic clusters of people who are much more closely related to each other than to anybody living today. By finding segments of shared DNA that descend from recent shared ancestors much more within those groups than across groups. So by utilizing these mutations and these genetic changes that arise at a pretty slow rate at any one position, but we have a huge genome, so we have a lot of information, we can obtain really accurate information. Our genomes are huge. They contain information of not just one pair of parents, but 4 grandparents, 8 great-grandparents, 16 great-great-grandparents. We literally have hundreds of thousands of ancestors writ in our genomes, and our single genomes tell the story of all of those ancestors, and by averaging the history of many of them, we can obtain really precise pictures of the sources of our DNA.
My guest is Harvard geneticist David Reich. He's author of Who We Are and How We Got Here. There are differences, that is undeniable, and there are differences between populations, but there's been, I think, a pretty widespread sense that admitting to genetic differences that perhaps correlate with skin color or ethnicity opens the door to the specter of scientific racism, of using this kind of information to justify racism. You actually have argued the exact opposite, that denying or glossing over these population-level differences could, in fact, open the door to racism. How so?
Well, I think that there are substantial differences in terms of time separation amongst human populations today. For example, Europeans, East Asians, Australians, and West Africans are all separated from each other by at least 40,000 years of of separation, not complete separation, but substantial separation in which the great majority of the gene pools have been separated for at least that long. That's quite a lot of time for evolution to act, and if there has been natural selection causing average differences amongst groups, that would have been enough time for average trait differences across the groups to develop. So we can't argue, as it sometimes is argued, that we're so similar that not enough time has elapsed for there to be differences. Now, we don't know very much yet about what the differences are amongst people, except for some differences in disease, like prostate cancer that we talked about before, or shallow superficial differences like skin color. And we also know that from genomic studies and from the ancient DNA revolution, that almost every time we think we have a bias coming in to thinking that something is going to be the case, a stereotype, it almost always is exploded when we actually look at real data. But we are confronted with being part of a species that has deep distinctions within it, of groups that have been separated for a long time. And so I think that we need to be ready to understand and think about and talk about whatever differences that arise. Now, you asked what the danger is of not talking about these differences. I think that approach that a lot of anthropologists and geneticists have had for the last half century and more has been to communicate the message that there are very few or there are no meaningful genetically determined differences across human populations. And I think that that message, which we often transmit, I think, hides probably the fact that, in fact, there is room for some differences, even if they're likely to be very modest. And because geneticists have not been providing a lot of guidance to the public about how to think about what differences there might be, and they're probably rather small on average, that space gets filled with people who are racist, or people who come up with to say that the stereotypes have been all correct all along. So I think that we geneticists have to provide guidance about how to think about these issues. That was what my article and what my book are about in that chapter.
And what is that guidance? I mean, obviously, in brief, not the full book format.
I think we just have to realize that there is space for average but modest differences amongst human populations, and we need to be ready to talk about and think about those differences, whatever they are.
Given the scale of globalization and migration at this point, do you think we are on the brink of erasing some of these population-level genetic differences, of turning the entire human race into one genetic population?
I think that there's sort of two answers to that. One answer is that we are in a very dramatic time of change right now. The last 500 years or so, people have been moving a lot recently, and groups that have been not in contact with each other much for tens of thousands of years are now mixing dramatically. But the other side of that question is actually we're not in an unusual time in history. What the ancient DNA revolution has shown is that again and again in the past, there have been equally profound mixtures of groups that are just as differentiated as the ones that are mixing now, for example, in the Americas to produce the Latino and African-American population and other populations. So that in India, between 2,000 to 4,000 groups years ago, groups just as different mixed to produce most of the people who live in India today. Similarly, in Europe, there's a tremendous mixture of, as I mentioned, four groups, each as different from each other, as Europeans and East Asians. In Africa, in the last 2,000 to 3,000 years, there have been profound movements of people from an ultimate source in West Africa all over the continent mixing with and displacing other groups. And so I don't think we live in such unusual times over the scope sweep of tens of thousands or even thousands of years. I don't know what the future holds, but I do know that we're constantly changing as a species in terms of the nature of our population structure.
David Reich is a professor of genetics at Harvard University, a Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator, and now author of Who We Are and How We Got Here. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Up next, the growing problem of plastic in the ocean. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.